The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, Jeremy Hutchinson and Alan Rusbridger, The Case for Liberty, was recorded at King's Place in June 2015. Here's Alan Rusbridger.
Good evening and welcome to this Guardian Live discussion with Jeremy Hutchinson. I want to begin with a little vignette, which is that a couple of years ago, 2013, there was an ill-fated Andrew Lloyd Webber musical about one of the trials that Jeremy was involved in, the trial of Stephen Ward, who was the some thought the fall guy in the Profumo case. And it coincided with a book by Jeffrey Robertson, the lawyer. And there was a press conference, do you remember, Jeremy, in which Mandy Rice Davis appeared with Andrew Lloyd Webber and Jeffrey. Yeah. And all the press and TV turned out, because even 50 years later, to see Mandy Rice Davis was quite something. It was that sensational a trial. And there was no question that Mandy Rice Davis was supposed to be the star of this event. As it turned out, she had laryngitis and she couldn't speak at all. But unquestionably, the star of the press conference was Jeremy Hutchinson, and he was 98 then. And he talked about the case in this crystal glass accent that made you think he was a member of the establishment. And he came out with such beautiful prose, such fierce and radical vehemence about the establishment in the 50s and the 60s, that one was taken back and one could understand why it was that this man was the star of the English bar for so long, and why when you got into trouble, whatever the form of trouble it was, you lifted the phone and tried to get this man to defend you. I'm going to just sketch over the highlights of his life because we want to get to the heart of the matter. But he was born in 1915. He was, if you like, on the fringes of the Bloomsbury set. I think Lytton Strachey taught you how to tie a bow tie when you were 15. Is that
correct?
Right? Yes, that's correct. He went to Oxford. He was in the Royal Navy. His ship HMS Kelly was sunk, and he bobbed to the surface, clinging to the same piece of wreckage as Lord Mountbatten. He stood for Labour in the famous 1945 election and canvassed Winston Churchill at 10 Downing Street, and then followed his father into the bar. And became involved in a series of cases that not only were incredibly famous at the time, but in some senses defined his generation. He went into the House of Lords, he was chairman of the Tate, he married Peggy Ashcroft and then June Osborne. He said he never wanted to write his autobiography because it's been a pretty dull life so far. He was just saying at the back, he said, I can't imagine why anybody would want to read about any of this, nor can we. But then his neighbour in Sussex, Thomas Grant, another barrister, came along and said, I would really like to write about your cases. And he found a giant tin trunk in your attic, I think, in which all these, there was a treasure trove of papers, and that has led to this book. £25, which I hope you'll buy lots of copies of at the back, some of them signed. And as if that wasn't enough, he's lived to be 100. Give him a round of applause just for a little bit. Yeah. My first question, Jeremy, is what's it like to be 100?
Well, the wonderful thing about getting to 100 is you suddenly become interesting for the first time. That's the first point. The second point is you can say anything about anything and there's no one there to correct you. So those are two of the up points. There are a lot of down points, I can tell you.
And you really knew Virginia Woolf and Lytton Strachey in that generation?
Well, there's a lot of talk about really knowing. People forget that when The Wasteland was published, I was 7 years old. And it wasn't until I got to my teens, really, that I appreciated these people. I'm afraid, as far as Bloomsbury is concerned, my sister and I used to mimic their voices, which were particularly funny. And so there was a certain amount of mocking going on in these rather grand areas. But it was only later I realised what remarkable people they were, of course.
Strachey had a very high-pitched voice.
Who?
Lytton Strachey had a very high-pitched voice.
Right? Yeah. He had a very high, squeaky voice. But the Bloomsbury's, when they spoke with this, yes, so interesting. Extraordinary thing I saw today. Amazing person coming along the road. So my sister and I used to have conversations with that sort of boy.
Well, what I thought we'd do this evening, there are four cases, there are many interesting cases in this book, and I thought we'd talk two that roughly around spies and intelligence, and two that are roughly around morality. And then we'll talk about the law today, and then we'll take questions from the hall. When we talk about the establishment, Jeremy, and the establishment in the 50s and early 60s, I mean, who were the establishment and what was it?
Well, there's always been the existence of the establishment. I think it started as a class thing. And now, of course, it's not a class thing anymore, basically. And it's being described very, very well as people who belong to a certain area of society who know that they're there for the purpose of ruling and don't have to discuss in smoke-filled rooms what their views are about problems. They know by instinct what their view is and will be shared by other members of this group of people.
And what stopped you becoming a member of the establishment? Because you went to public school, you went to Oxford, you went to the Inns of Court. You were on course for being a signed-up life member.
Anybody who lived through the 30s, you know, people don't know about how awful the 30s were and the division between those who ruled the roost and the others was so enormous. And the unemployment of the north of England and the Baldwin government and the slow drift into inevitable war and so on. I think when one was young, one was enormously conscious of this division in society. And in those days, you see, the whole question of politics was on such a different level from what it is now. It was there was a philosophy in politics. There were endless arguments about social democracy as opposed to communism, as opposed to enlightened Toryism. And people wrote books about it. In the Golanx Press, one read avidly the books that came out. And one bought the New Statesman, but at the same time one bought Time and Tide. And all this was discussed, and the whole question of nationalization, and then fascism against communism and so on, was all in quite a different kind of level from what it is today. And I think if one was a thinking person and one was young and realized the huge apartheid between private education and ordinary education and the existence of the establishment. One saw, for instance, the Jarrow marchers marching along Piccadilly. One couldn't but be conscious of how awful it was, the situation, politically.
We could talk a lot about that, but I'm going to take you... The link is the establishment, so I think we'll come back to that. But we're going to jump to 1963, and the most famous woman in Britain at the time, after the Queen, was Christine Keeler. And one day, you're in your chambers, and she walks in. What was your impression of the woman who walked into your room?
Well, you see, the whole Profumo scandal was enormously definitive of the age, really. And Christine Keeler was a central figure in the whole business of because of Jack Profumo having this affair with her. And she was taken up by the press, of course, and was pictured as a wicked, terrible woman who ruined the lives of the people she slept with, and that she was a sort of tart in and so on. And the real truth of the matter was that Christine Keeler was a very pathetic figure. She had the most awful bringing up. Was brought up in a sort of almost a disused garage, and had a child aborted at the age of 16, and eventually came to London and got jobs in sleazy clubs and so on, and then was suddenly taken up by Ward, who was, as everybody now knows, was an extraordinary character. He was obviously fascinated by what was going on in the sex world, as it were. He was a voyeur rather than a performer, and met Christine in one of these sleazy clubs, and he had this house on Lord Astor's estate, and Clifton, which he entertained these girls who he groomed, really. But
And it was a scandal because Jack Profumo was the junior defence minister, and
yes,
another visitor to Clifton, and in fact they were in the same swimming pool at the same time, was the emissary at the Russian embassy, Ivanov. So that was how scandal was created of it, because
there was a swimming pool which belonged to Lord Astor. And he allowed his guests, Ward and his guests, to swim in the swimming pool. And Ward was there with his house party, as it were, and then along came Lord Astor with his grandees, and Profumo was one of them. And Profumo fell for Christine in the swimming pool, and of course got her telephone number, and of course rang her up, and had this quite short, rather boring relationship, which was purely sex with her. And this Russian, of course, was also a friend of Ward's, and also took up with her. And of course, once this got out, the press were onto it and made a sort of huge story about the Russian and the Minister of War sharing a prostitute, and a lot of sort of pillow talk about him discussing abstruse subjects and so on with her, passing them on to Profumo. It was all complete rubbish, of course. But anyhow, she eventually got charged with, for a time, two or three years, she led this life with Ward and being introduced to all these grand people. I don't think she really knew what was going on. She was absolutely moving from one person to another, totally unlike Mandy, who was her friend, who had her head totally screwed on and knew exactly what was going on. And then she got this attraction for West Indians in London and got into the world of drug pushing and so on, and was obviously very attracted physically by black men. And as a result of all that, quite apart from the whole Profumo thing, she got into trouble with that underworld of drug pushing and so on. And eventually there was a trial, and she told a lot of untruths about this Baron Gordon, for whom she became very, very frightened. And she was charged with perjury, and so I represented her. And it was the last act of the Profumo scandal. And she was charged with committing perjury. And she came into my chambers, and of course, all my colleagues were looking through the keyholes of their doors, seeing, and she was an absolute dream of beauty. There's no question about it at all. And she came into my room, and she sat down there, and I talked to the solicitor and so on. And then I turned to her and asked her a question. And when she spoke, her voice was so hideous and so awful. It was the voice of someone who was tired of life altogether and hard. And it suddenly her whole attraction disappeared. And it made me realize how important people's voices are, something we don't notice, really. And
what was going on in Britain that summer? I mean, Bernard Levin wrote about it as a moment of collective insanity. I mean, people thought that the whole of the British political establishment was degenerate and that there were orgies all over the place. And it was a sort of very fevered atmosphere that was the background to these trials.
Yes, you see, but the press built it up tremendously, as you can imagine. And then they got hold of Keeler, of course, and paid her large sums of money for interviews, which they wrote for her to sign. And she just signed them, and then got $5,000 for the article, of course. And they created all these stories. And she really wasn't understanding what was going on, I don't think.
Was the pursuit of Stephen Ward, was that corrupt?
Was what?
The pursuit of Stephen Ward, Was that corrupt?
It was an appalling miscarriage of justice, and Geoffrey Robertson has written a brilliant book about it. And the behaviour of the establishment in that case, I mean, they were determined to get Ward some way or the other, because they looked upon him as the central figure. And the Macmillan government was in real trouble and eventually fell, as you know, as a result of all this. And they were determined to get Ward. And as Geoffrey Robertson writes up in his book, I mean, the Home Secretary had a meeting with the head of Scotland Yard, the head of MI5, and literally asking the intelligence and the police whether Ward, in their view, committed an offence on which they could get him. And the MI5 man said, no, there's no evidence at all that anything has arisen on the security side. And the police officer said, well, there's not really any evidence to commit a criminal offence, but we might get him in relation to living on the immoral earnings of these women that he put up and groomed. And they literally went out and simply pinned on him, interviewed hundreds of people, hundreds of his friends, and pinned on him evidence that Ward had in fact lived on their immoral earnings, which was completely untrue. And of course these girls weren't, it was living on the immoral earnings of prostitution. Of course they weren't prostitutes, they were good time girls. They chose the men that they wanted to sleep with. They weren't there ready to just pay so much an hour or whatever it was. And
that was a terrible miscarriage of justice. Was that common at the time that there were these, or was it the exception?
No, I think that was completely an exception. And of course Ward, at the last day of his trial, realised that the judge was going to sum up for a prosecution, and quite coolly decided he was going to commit suicide because he couldn't face the whole thing of going to prison and being disgraced. And he did commit suicide the night before he was due to go to court for the summing up.
Did you see the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical?
Yeah.
What did you think of it?
Careful. I didn't think the music was all that wonderful, but it was too complicated.
Too complicated.
It was a brilliant effort actually, and it was amazing. It was wonderful that Lloyd Webber wanted to make a musical about such a serious matter, but he brought in everything, but I wondered how it could possibly turn into a musical. It was too complicated, really. Mm.
2 years earlier, George Blake. Now, this was a difficult case for you because, in many ways, he was an unattractive defendant. He was a self-confessed spy. I think in the book it says, on his own account, he admitted he could have betrayed 400 agents, though he claimed he had an agreement with the Russians that none of them would be harmed. When you met him, it says in the book, you found him a man of immense charm, and you were immediately taken with him.
It could hardly be called a tremendous triumph, you know, to secure the longest term of imprisonment that's ever been passed on anybody. However, it forms part of this book.
You're rushing ahead, yeah.
No, he was someone of a very delightful personality, actually. And I found him a very interesting person. to deal with. And I think his... he wasn't English, for goodness sake. He was Dutch. And he was brought up in Holland. He was a Calvinist. He wanted to begin with to go into the church. He was therefore, which was very important, thinking of his character. And he went through appalling deprivation when he was out in Korea and so on, and took part in this forced march with a lot of American soldiers who were misbehaved in a rather dreadful kind of way. And he spent 2 years locked up with the only literature he had was Marx and Engels and so on. And during that period, he read Das Kapital, which is a very remarkable book. And I think he was genuinely convinced that communism was an alternative to what he'd seen, how the Americans behaved, of the capitalist system. And people forget that at that time, it was perfectly respectable at a university to be a communist. I mean, communism was something that everybody talked about. Communism as such had a philosophy. And I think he was genuinely became a communist for religious reasons almost.
Did you ever flirt with communism? Were you ever attracted to it?
No, not at all.
Because?
Not at all. Endless arguments when I was at university about it. But I remained stubbornly a social democrat.
If you'd gone to Cambridge instead of Oxford, it might have been very
different.
So there you were, you're faced with him, and it, as you say, a difficult case to defend, but your job was to put in a plea in mitigation.
Yes.
And your argument was, he is what you see. He's a genuine idealist. He didn't do it for money.
Well, the whole business of spying, it's so equivocal, isn't it? I mean, to be a spy against your country, you're a traitor. To spy for your country, you're a hero. And the whole thing is incredibly awful and terribly squalid. And whether it's worse to be a spy for money or for conviction, who knows?
I think in your speech, you talked about the canker of espionage, and you said, as long as it is continued to rot the goodwill between men, so long there will be people like George Blake.
Yes, well, that's what I sincerely believe. Yeah. Yes.
Another difficulty in conducting the case was that it was so secret there was almost nothing you could talk about in court.
Well,
that's what they said anyway.
That was what they said. You see, I was a very young silk. I'd only just taken silk, and it was still an age of deference, and to appear before the Lord Chief Justice in itself was pretty alarming. And to have as one's opponent the Attorney General was equally alarming.
He was a particularly alarming Attorney General, wasn't he?
He was.
Manningham Buller.
He was.
Or Bullingham Manor, as he
was. Bullingham Manor. Yeah. And his attitude, as I say in the book, was the only time I ever experienced at the bar for another member of the bar to treat one as he treated me was quite unbelievable, really. And the case was conducted on the basis of everything in it was too secret to mention. And I was faced with this question of going into camera or doing my mitigation in public. And I couldn't mitigate for Blake unless I referred to secret matters, of course. So we had to go into camera, and therefore his mitigation was never heard by the public, as it were. And when we went into secrecy, the attitude of Manningham Buller and the judge was, if I asked Manningham Buller before we went into court, and when I saw him before going into court, are you going to say that he's betrayed numbers of agents? If you are going to say that, I want to know what the evidence is and what happened to the agents. I want to know what the evidence is. Oh, too secret, can't be mentioned. So one was completely unable to make any serious mitigation for him because one wasn't allowed to know what the essence of the case was. But somehow the judge and the prosecutor knew the essence of the case. I didn't know the essence of the case.
Anyway, as you say, you were tremendously unsuccessful.
Tremendously unsuccessful.
You were tremendously unsuccessful. He was put away for 42 years.
Well, it was a completely unheard of sentence. And it was an administrative sentence, which it doesn't happen in our legal system.
It was a political sentence.
You know, totally political, yeah. Obviously.
Yeah. But you said in your speech that such a sentence would cause him either to lose his sanity or gain his freedom. And he did gain his freedom.
That was a good moment. That was a wonderful moment. And
are you allowed to say that as a member of the bar?
What?
That a man escaping from prison is a good moment.
Yes, but this was an exceptional case. And the extra pleasure I got out of it was that, of course, I, like everybody else, wagged us. Everybody came up to me, of course, here. How on earth could the worst traitor we've ever had in this country escape from Wormwood Scrubs? It's unheard of. Oh, I know, that's obviously KGB agreement with MI5 and... we should get somebody back in exchange for Blake. Blah, 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 blah. And, of course, it turned out to be a completely amateur effort. And two principals...
two called Randall and Pottle, who...
Yes, who were both ex-clients of mine. That was all so enjoyable.
And they were later... charged with helping him to escape and acquit him.
Yes, I mean, this ridiculous moment. Blake, being very, very intelligent, of course, got the best job in the prison, which was looking after the library. And everything in prison is exact. Everything is all routine. So at 11 precisely, he was let out of his cell to walk across to the library on the other side of the perimeter. And when he got there, that door was unlocked, and in he went and looked after the library. So somehow, in those early days, my two dear fellows, Pottle and Randall, had got in one of the early mobile telephones. And we had this Irishman who was the third person, was outside. And they'd agreed, the Irishman got hold of made a ladder with knitting needles and silk, so it was very, very light, and there was a public footpath on the perimeter part of the prison, and it was agreed that at exactly 11:04, Blake would be walking across to the library, and that over the wall would come the ladder. So off he went, and sure enough, over came this ladder. So Blake seized the ladder, whizzed up the ladder, got over the wall, and dropped on the other side. And there was the Irishman walking along the footpath to a car parked at the end, put him in the boot of the car, and drove off. End of story. and they hid him in a nearby flat which they'd taken. And of course, the whole country was every aerodrome, port, God knows what, was watched. There he was, only half a mile from the prison, in a flat, locked up quietly. And then in due course, Randall and his wife, who came to my book launch the other day, I may say, took a camper van with a specially arranged boot in the back, which Randall had created, and drove on holiday across the channel, and then drove off through France and Germany to the Russian, to what was it called, what not Charlie, the gate into Russia. Yeah. Said, we've got something interesting here for you. Opened the boot and delivered Blake. Yes, then they wrote a book about it.
Yes, yeah.
And they came and consulted me and said, will we be charged? I said, you're bound to be charged, although it's years later, because the one thing the establishment and the civil service cannot abide is being made fools of in public. And so you're bound to be prosecuted. But they went on
got off.
And were charged. Mm. And I Geoffrey Robertson represented them. Mm. And until they got to the moment when they had to form the defence, and their defence was they acted under duress. And when Geoffrey said, well, what was the duress? Well, we were so appalled by the 42-year sentence. we could not do anything but get him out of prison. So Geoffrey had to say, oh, I'm sorry, there's not duress in law. So he said, if you're going to put that forward as a defence, you'll have to represent yourselves from that. And they did, and they did it absolutely brilliantly. Yeah. And the jury thought, the judge was simply furious and said, this isn't a defence. I tell you, in law, this isn't a defence. Retire and come back with your verdict. And they came back and said, not guilty.
Well, talking of the establishment being made fools of, let's skip back now to Lady Chatterley, 1960, another case about morality. And this was Penguin Books being sued over Lawrence's novel. You had to prove either that the book wasn't obscene or that there was such literary merit in it that there was a public interest in it being published.
Yeah.
So this was really the seminal obscenity case, wasn't it?
Well, it was the test case of the new legislation, which Roy Jenkins had got through the House of Commons. When you were, for the first time in a question of obscenity, given a defence, which the onus was on you to prove, but you were given a defence that the book, even if it was obscene, should be published for the public good on the fact that it had literary or scientific or whatever merits and for other reasons or whatever it was.
And the way that you set out to prove that was to call this array of distinguished witnesses, men such as E.M. Foster and Richard Hoggart, who came along and spoke about the book's literary merits.
Well, the wonderful thing, Lady Chatterley, for a criminal barrister was that instead of defending some rapist or alleged rapist or murderer or fraudsman, suddenly one was representing, although one was representing Penguin, one was rarely representing D.H. Lawrence. And the case was not a case of fact, it was a case of opinion. And to sit in number one court at the Old Bailey and think of all the appalling people who'd sat in that dock, And the dock was empty because, of course, the company was being prosecuted, no individual. And I got there early, and I just saw, sitting in the dock, D.H. Lawrence with his little beard and his bright eyes, sitting there where all these appalling people had sat, charged with these appalling criminal offences. And what was he charged with? The irony of it. He was charged with writing a book, the purpose of which was to make the sexual intercourse, save the sexual intercourse from the dirty-minded approach that it was now surrounded with, and to rescue the four-letter words from their original, and put them back in their original meaning. And there he was, as it were, being tried in court number one at the Old Bailey.
And the hero of the case, apart from yourself, was really Richard Hoggart, wasn't he? The literary critic, father of Simon Hoggart. And from the account in the book, it was the fact that he was himself working class and a distinguished scholar of Lawrence, and he explained Lawrence in a kind of way that was unchallengeable.
He was the absolute ideal witness for those reasons, and also having been brought up in the Midlands and knew all about the area and the culture of that part of England. He was the absolutely ideal witness, and I think really the most enjoyable time in my professional life really was taking Hoggart through his evidence in that case. It was so enjoyable getting him. I was determined that Lawrence's prose should be heard by the jury, and that we should get away from this concentration on the sex, because the description in the book are so beautifully written, some of them. And so I read out particular passages in the book, and there was absolute silence in court, and it was extraordinarily moving, really, to hear these passages, these beautiful passages read out in court number one, then at the end of them being able to say to Hoggart, "What is your view about that?" And then he would give these wonderful answers. And of course he was the ideal person. And the marvelous moments when my policy in obscenity cases was always to face up to the what's called the worst bits of the book, not to hide them away, and to bring them out and read them, so you could hear their context and so on. And these passages about the reverence being shown for a man's testicles, and this wonderful passage about all this with Mervyn Griffiths Jones for the prosecution cross-examining Hoggart and saying, "What? Reverence for a man's balls?" and Hoggart saying, "Yes, indeed, reverence." A passage which illustrates that he's in the great tradition, the English tradition of Puritanism, what Puritanism? Yes, indeed. To hear this again in the Old Bailey was absolutely fascinating.
And I just want to hear from you, because I think you were looking at the jurors when Mervyn Griffiths-Jones, who was prosecuting, came out with perhaps the most famous line of the case, when he said, "Would you even wish your wife or your servants to read this book?"
And you... Well, that was a glorious moment, because then one knew that the case was going to turn from obscenity into a case of them and us, of course, Gerald Gardner, who, you know, only came into the case at the last minute. That was why I had such a lot. I had to have a lot to do in conducting it. Mm. Gerald Gardner gave a marvelous exhibition of advocacy. Couldn't have done it better. But he was the perfect person as against Mervyn Griffiths-Jones. I mean, Griffiths-Jones was really a very nice man, but I mean, he was an old Etonian, a guards officer, a man of utter principle, who couldn't believe that this book could be acquitted. It never entered his head that it was possible. And Joe Gardner, representing the opposite side of the world, couldn't have done it better. Mm.
I mean, your career coincided with these huge social changes of the abolition of the death penalty, the decriminalization of homosexuality, the huge changes over obscenity. Is Britain a kinder and gentler place today as a result of those changes that were often driven through the courts at the time that you were practicing?
I think it's a much better place, really. I mean, if you're... People don't remember how constrained society was in those days, you know. There was a real them and us atmosphere. The Official Secrets Act was all right for us to know about these things, but not for you. And I had the luck to live in those 30 years, really, during the 50s, 60s and 70s, when this whole edifice, really, was gradually demolished, or largely demolished, of secrecy, and censorship, and the whole them and us, and deference, and so on. Mm. And I think now we are a much freer, a much more open society than we were then. Mm. But of course, if you've demolished something, you naturally open up other problems. Mm. And tend, of course, to go too far very often.
I want to talk about one final case, and your mention of the Official Secrets Act is the link there, and that this was a case much later, 1978, the so-called ABC trial, which was three defendants, Aubrey, Berry and Campbell, and one of them was a retired Army signals expert, and the other two were journalists on Time Out. And you defended Duncan Campbell, who was the one that the state were really out to get. And the thrust of your defence was that this stuff wasn't secret. There was a ludicrous amount of secrecy around the operations of intelligence at the time.
Yes, Duncan Campbell, who was another of my clients, attended my book launch the other day, which was very nice. He was a remarkable young man, and he got a first at Oxford, and he turned into an expert on electronics, and from that into the whole surveillance world. And made it his business to discover what was going on in this country. Because at that time, again, people will don't remember, MI5, MI6 didn't exist. They were not mentioned in the press at all. And as for GCHQ at Cheltenham, completely unknown. The fact that we had listening posts in Cyprus and in other parts of the world, completely unknown. And of course, the only people who really knew about it are the Russians. Of course, they knew about it, naturally. But the British public knew nothing. And so he set about collecting information about the whole setup and where it was and what it was doing, and burrowed away into documents and so on, and amassed a whole mass of information about the whole apparatus of our surveillance powers. And he helped to write an article about this, which appeared in Time Out. And of course, that caused an absolute rumpus in the security services.
The claim was that it had done it exceptionally grave damage to the national interest.
Yes.
Did it?
Well, it turned out, of course, that all the information that was disclosed was information which had been gathered from public sources. There was no suggestion, of course, that these three people, young men, were working for the Russians or were traitors in any shape or form. But all the paraphernalia of the trial with black mirage and so on going on and charges under Section 1 of the Official Secrets Act and policemen with guns on the door and all that was all built up for their trial at the Old Bailey. And when Mr. X and Colonel Y come into the witness box and you begin to question them, and the first question you say, do you work at so-and-so? My lord, I'm not allowed to answer that question. Is this a picture of your... My lord, I'm not allowed to answer that question. And then gradually, one proved that all the information that's been collected was all been collected from documents and photographs and so on, which are, and all that the people had done was to collect the information and then publicize it.
I asked you about Edward Snowden round the back, and you said you didn't know a great deal about him and you didn't know what damage he'd caused, but you broadly approved of getting more information about this area of life into the public domain.
Yes, I think his disclosure about what's going on in the surveillance world was admirable to disclose that. What harm he'd done to our intelligence, I don't know. But certainly the power now of the state, and I'm not at the moment going on how much they use it or not, the power of the state is now enormous, that you can in fact survey any individual for 24 hours a day. And as people from Google and Facebook and so on on the record for saying, privacy is over. That is, there is no longer privacy. And when you think that there are people employed by the state who can get up and have a good breakfast, say goodbye to their family, go to a nice, comfortably central heated room, sit in front of a screen, and simply by manipulating the information on the screen can bump off someone in Pakistan or in the Middle East. And in doing so, of course, sometimes making a mistake and bumping off the wrong person, or, of course, bumping off 15 other people at the same time, which is covered by the phrase collateral damage. Now, no one seems to mind this at all. And this is perfectly simple murder, what we call it in this country, against international law. And it is going on, and nobody seems to mind. But the public, the power of the state now is enormous, and that's why in my piece I've written in this book, I point out the appalling danger of making it impossible for ordinary people anymore to have the services of a good advocate.
And let's come to that point, because I'm just going to read a bit from your there's a postscript in this book which you've written, and you talk about the abolition of the office of Lord Chancellor on a whim. The second greatest office of state was destroyed after 800 years, and then you write this. Of course, the presence of an unelected judge amid a group of democratically elected politicians was, on the face of it, an anachronism. But the modern acceptable replacement turns out to be but a puny shadow of the past. Enter Mr. Grayling. Enter Mr. Grayling, whose job before entering Parliament is recorded as management consultant. A transient workaday politician on his way up the political ladder, Minister of Justice with the title of Lord Chancellor, with no experience of the law, no knowledge of how the criminal process works, no understanding of the delicate checks and balances we have put in place over the last 50 years to bring justice to all people. In the excess of his management skills, he has deliberately destroyed the present system, and in doing so, in all probability, the proper functioning of the criminal bar. So what do you really think about him?
No, as I say in that book, I hope the book will entertain and amuse people, because it's so incredibly well written by Tom Grant. And the idea of the book is to take... He chose the cases, and it's his writing if the book is a success. It chose the cases which had relevance to what was going on in society. It's not a book about murders and rapes and frauds and such like, which, of course, is the basis of one's practice at the criminal bar. And that's why these cases have been chosen. But underneath it all, although there's a lot of fun in the book, I think, and a lot of quite interesting social things to be said about it, underneath it there is a serious, serious message. And that is the message which you've read out there. Because it's not saying that lawyers are wonderful people or lawyers are special people. The fact is, as everybody knows, that the law, in fact, supports the whole of society. You can't have a society without law. And it's the basis of society. And if you're an autocrat, the first thing you do, as we see in all sorts of countries, is to make it impossible for the advocate, the lawyer, to operate. That's how you begin. And in no autocratic country is there a free bar, as it were, or free legal system.
Is your main worry about the access to justice now, because poor people now can't afford to represent themselves, to be represented? Is that your main worry?
Yes, you see, both. It's curious because both the Labour Prime Minister, now Tory Prime Minister, who, in my view, are both people whose whole background is really presentation all the time. Blair just got rid of the office of Lord Chancellor on the back of an envelope because there was a dispute about between the Lord Chancellor, Lord Irvine, and his Home Secretary. And Irvine was saying, you can't do that because it's not within the law, the rule of law. You mustn't do that to Blunkett, the Home Secretary. And Blair decided that Blunkett should do what he wanted to do, and just simply not only got rid of the Lord Chancellor, but got rid of this interfering office called the Lord Chancellor. Well, now, as I say in the book, it's an anachronism to have a judge sitting along a lot of democratically elected politicians, but it was in our curious constitution. It was a central pillar of the Constitution because there was the representative of the rule of law sitting in the center of power, saying to his colleagues, no, you can't do that. And watching throughout, the government obeyed the rule of law. He was got rid of, and then was created the Ministry of Justice. And the Minister of Justice has been given the name of Lord Chancellor. And as I say, it's a puny office. And the Lord Chancellor is now allowed to be a non-lawyer, which is completely ridiculous. He's the man who's in daily touch with ministers of the Crown, telling them what the law is, telling them that they can do this or they can do that. And it seems to me the contempt of the politicians to allow the Lord Chancellor to be a layman, as I say, on his way up the ordinary political scale, knowing nothing about the law at all, is to me almost beyond belief. And that's the situation we have today. And of course, Mr. Grayling has now slashed the ability to allow legal aid. There are whole swathes of this country where you can't get legal aid. There are whole areas where you have to travel 20 or 30 miles to get to the source of legal aid, which people, of course, don't bother or can't afford to do. And as a result, now there are many, many, many people, or kind of people that I've spent my life representing, who cannot be represented. And they are appearing in court defending themselves. And it's a very, very serious situation, I think.
Can I ask you one other thing about what's happening in the law today? So you fought in the Second World War. You know what the Second World War was about. You lost friends in the Second World War. And one of the responses to the war was to create the European Convention on Human Rights, which was 1950. Did you think you would live to an age where people would want to scrap that?
Well, that's the other incredible. I find incredible that I don't think politicians now have any sense of history at all. They certainly don't have any philosophy. They have no sense of history. If we could look back on the 30s, in the 30s, all these countries in Europe building up their armaments, fascist governments in Spain, in Italy, and in Germany, or in Russia, communism, dictatorship, everyone at each other's throats. Well, the war is fought, the war is won, and one of the first things that happened was to have the whole concept of human rights at the United Nations. And when the EU was formed, the Convention of Human Rights, largely and mostly drafted by English lawyers, incorporating from all our attitude to freedom from Magna Carta onwards. And the miraculous situation now that these countries in Eastern Europe, who only such a short time ago were communist countries under the domination of Russia, if they're to join the EU, they have to sign up to the convention, the Human Rights Convention, involving all the things that we stand for, the rule of law, democracy, and so on. And they've signed up. And it's an amazing situation. I can't believe they
want it. Amazing situation that Britain should be now talking about.
I mean, 44 nations have signed up to the human rights. And we, who were the basis, the founder of the convention, really, now want to get out of it. I find it incredible. There we are.
A round of applause for that, if nothing else. While you're clapping, while we can bring up the house lights so that we can see who's... I think we should just give a round of applause to Thomas Grant, who's sitting down there.
My hearing is not what's called 100%.
Can the author just take a bow at this stage? There is... Okay, we've got a microphone there and a microphone there, and the first person with their hands up, I will. There's two hands down there and no hands over there. You're all asleep over there, so we'll come back to you later. So, first question over here.
Thank you. I was at London Business School recently, where Linda Grattan and Andrew Scott gave a lecture about the demographics of the future. Apparently, anyone born beyond the year 2007 is very likely to live to the age of 100. What advice would you give them?
I couldn't hear, I'm sure.
Right, so the thought is that anybody who was born in the year 2007 is very likely to end up as old as you are. And the question...
Older.
Older. Yeah. What advice would you give anybody going to have a life as long as yours?
Of living to 100...
How to lead a good life.
Oh, well, do you mean how to behave in order to reach 100?
How to pace yourself.
Well, my family motto, translated into English, is neither rash nor fearful. And my rather tearaway sister used to say, typically Hutchinson, lukewarm. but in fact, moderation isn't a bad thing. I would like to add to the motto, but the periodic binge.
very good advice. Right at the front here.
Mr. Hutchinson, thank you so very much. I wanted to talk to you about my one very small triumph when I fed you a nugget that you were able to introduce into a debate in the House of Lords on the perennial subject of the right of jury trial. Well, I fed you the nugget, but boy, what you did with it. You said, did the cat leap out of the bag when on the 12th of February, I think it was 2002, Jack Straw said he had finally decided to do away with jury trial because otherwise people would choose jury trial to take human rights points. Well, we, or rather you, won that round, but thank you very much for that. I wanted to say this as well. It's like acting. It's the reading of the line. Did you used to suffer, as so many of us at the bar, and I'm a solicitor advocate, did you used to suffer from the sweaty palms, the thudding heart, the dry throat, and the loss of sleep when you had a difficult case? So many of yours were difficult. Did you go through all that, or did you just sail serenely through it?
I didn't quite get the end. Did I go through what?
I'll summarize it. I'm not doing justice to the question, but did you get nervous before you appeared in your cases?
Before what? Before what?
Before your cases, when you were about to make a wonderful speech. And so, the serious point is, often you were sometimes appearing in cases where, well, quite often people's lives were at risk.
Yes.
It was all on your honeyed words that the things hung in balance.
Of course one gets nervous. I think if you don't get nervous, you're probably no good at it. But the reason why barristers are so absolutely delightful as people is because, unlike tycoons and people in business and sitting in their offices, we are constantly humiliated. And I think it's very good for one, really. You can work your socks off sitting up to all hours of the night, prepare a long case which may go on, say, for 2 or 3 weeks or a month, working like mad, and every day cross-examining and examining witnesses. And at the end of all that, one word, guilty, and everything you've done has been completely pointless. And sometimes your duty, as you know, is not to decide whether your client's guilty or not, but to put his case. You are his mouthpiece, and it's your duty to put his case, not to disclose what your own view of his case, and if possible, not to have a view. Your job is to put his case. And of course, some people's cases are almost ridiculous, and therefore, there you are standing up. And you see your client beforehand, who five witnesses have all seen with a smoking gun in his hand, and you say, "Well, Mr. So-and-so, what are we going to say about this?" "I wasn't there," he said. "What do you mean you weren't there?" "Wasn't me." "Well, five people, two of whom have known you for 20 years, say you were there." "I wasn't there." "Well, then you have to conduct this case." And then halfway, someone has been had, say, drugs planted on them by a dishonest police officer, and the police officer not only does that, but says it will make a confession afterwards, which you never made, you're there cross-examining the police officer, and you, at some moment the judge will tap on his table and say, Mr. Hutchinson, I just want to get it completely clear. Is your defence of this defendant that no less than 5 police officers are all telling untruth? Yes, my lord. And 3 police officers have put their heads together to make a false confession. Yes, my lord. Very well. That's called humiliation.
Did you like Rumpole?
Did I what?
Like Rumpole?
Did I like Rumpole?
Yes.
Are you talking about John Mortimer?
No, I'm talking about the thing he wrote.
Oh, the books?
Or the TV series.
Oh, I love them.
Oh,
yes.
Good, right.
Yes. Absolutely love them.
Let's have a question from this side. We're going to try and match. Okay, we've got too many men, but we'll try for gender balance as well as... Yes, sir. Oh, nobody's got a microphone. Oh, there's a woman at the back. Oh, there we go. Sorry, I thought you had a microphone. We'll come back to you. Yep, okay, we'll... Oh, there's a microphone up there. We're very clever. Right, okay.
I just wish... I'm a farmer. I'm a livestock farmer. And I do take on board everything you have said about the establishment. They don't like to be wrong. They've poisoned the shepherds. And now I'm a cattle farmer. And we have to inject cattle material into our cows. And the vets use the same needle for TB testing. And they don't understand why TB is increasing. It's all about biodiversity, it's all about biosecurity down on the farm, but nothing at the laboratories, nothing for the vets. But then we're not allowed to comment because we're not qualified to comment. I'm not even qualified to say whether my cows are healthy or not. Because
you
I have...
You are qualified to ask a question, so okay. If I can push you for a question.
I've got a whole pile of
information. I bet you have, yeah.
And I just like, the question is, can you find somebody that would be interested either in the law or in journalism to take it on and get some justice?
Okay. Everyone look to see who you're standing at the back. You're very distinct. And there are probably lots of journalists and lawyers in the audience. That's where to find you. They'll come find you at the end. Somebody at the back in the balcony. Yes, I can't see you, but you can see me. Yeah. The question was, you've had an amazing career that we've been hearing about tonight with all these wonderful cases. Had there been cases that you would have liked to have been involved in and you've watched from the sidelines?
Well, I certainly would have liked to have defended a Ward, actually, who was defended by my pupil master, Jimmy Burge, and... I have to say, he's no longer with us anyhow, and I think he didn't really do a very good job for Ward. And I'd like to have defended Ward because Ward needed someone who would stand up and really fight the evidence against him, and. Not adopt a sort of avoiding attitude towards it. But of course there are cases which come up where one feels what fun it would have been or how interesting it would have been to have done them. But on the whole, if you have a busy practice, one has to get on with one's own practice, not think about other ones.
On this side... Has somebody got a microphone there? There's a question around the front there. And then if somebody wants to wave their hand over... Oh, there's a gentleman there who I missed first time. So let's have this woman here. Yeah.
Mr. Hutchinson, could I ask you what is the current situation on blasphemy in this country?
The question is about blasphemy, and if you can explain...
What?
The question was about blasphemy, And whether you can explain what the current state of play with blasphemy is. Because you were obviously involved in cases like the Romans in Britain.
I don't know. I mean, Tom would probably ask the question better than me. I don't know the present situation about blasphemy, I'm afraid.
That's a good answer, Ryan. always best to be honest. Tom's a civil lawyer rather than a criminal lawyer. Okay, we've got. Yes, sir.
Or types of defendants you wouldn't act for. For example, Pol Pot, any of the Nazi war criminals or anybody you would choose not to act for.
I think that's a question about the cab rank principle.
Yeah.
You're supposed to be blind to who you take on, but the questioner was asking whether, in fact, there were any people you wouldn't take on, and he wondered whether you would take on Pol Pot or Nazi war criminals and defend them. Or even Chris Grayling.
Yes, of course I would. Of course I would. I mean, certainly in my day, if you were a criminal practitioner, you did obey the cab rank principle that you took the next case which were offered to you, however unpleasant or however awful it was. And I think the whole basis of one's practice was that one did follow that. Of course, there were ways of getting round it if you wanted to, but I think on the whole, one did have, that was part of one's, the basis on which one worked, really. One didn't ask, one had a job to do. If the person was charged with an offence, however awful and unpleasant the offence was, it was your job to get on. And the curious thing is that nearly always, in every case, there's something to be said on the other side. And it's amazing how many cases which seem completely dead, suddenly the truth emerges. Even during the trial, people are so obviously guilty of an offence, and then suddenly it looms that in fact, he's not guilty or she's not guilty, it was somebody else or whatever it was. So yes, the answer is yes, I would take on any case.
There's a hand there, right by the microphone there, and Did we find... Have we got somebody over there? Is there somebody over there waiting? No. Right in the middle there. Okay. Well, while we're getting the microphone there, let's have this question here.
You mentioned about the position of Lord Chancellor being regarded as an anachronism, but how would you regard the situation with the House of Lords? Because it's quite a taste for an elected House of Lords. But I'm quite anxious about discarding... the accumulated experience and expertise that does sit there. It's not perfect by any means, but there's a lot of accumulated experience and expertise, and I'm not sure that always the democratically elected representatives may be always in the best position to make serious judgments and to hold the democratically elected chamber to account.
The question is about the House of Lords. I think, were one of the first peers to resign from the House of Lords. Were you happy about being in the House of Lords, even though many people say it's an undemocratic body? The questioner was really saying, isn't there an advantage in having it being undemocratic if it's got people of experience and expertise like you in it?
My own view about the House of Lords is, I mean, at the moment it's completely ridiculous, but my own view about it is that it should be two-thirds elected and one-third appointed, because I think it's valuable to have people who aren't politicians in the House of Lords. But I think it ought to be an elected body in this day and age. I think at the moment the situation is completely ridiculous. I mean, there are 750 peers, and they cannot perform, they won't perform themselves. I mean, when I left the House of Lords, I made an impassioned speech to them to say, there are a whole lot of things you could do. First of all, bring in an age limit, for goodness sake. I mean, it's unbelievable that people totter into the House of Lords.
How old were you at the time that you made the speech?
In my late 80s, I think. I mean, if I hadn't resigned, I could now, at 100 years old, go in and be part of the legislature. It's absolutely ridiculous. Completely ridiculous. And all this paraphernalia about being called a lord and spouses being m'lady and all that. I mean, the noble this, noble that. All this could be altered overnight and made more efficient. And I mean, there ought 400 or 350 is quite a big enough number to run a second chamber on. And all this talk about these wonderful people who get into the House of Lords, of course, they are, a lot of them are wonderful people. And they must be so disillusioned when they get there, because, of course, we have these wonderful ex-army and navy people. We have artists, we have philosophers, we have every kind of person coming into the Lords. But they don't participate. All these wonderful people, they don't participate. I mean, some very distinguished person like Melvin Bragg, for instance. I mean, who could be better? But the debate about any subject on which he knows, perhaps twice in a year, you talk about something to do with the arts. I mean, it's all a nonsense.
I think we've got time for one more question. And I can't see who's... Yeah, right, in the middle. Okay, at the back.
Hi, so I've spent my whole adult life... has been after the sort of onset of the war on terror, and it's often felt like Western democracies are giving up on the rule of law. We're moving things to ministerial choices, prolonged detention without trial, as you were mentioning, less support for legal representation. And I just wanted to know from someone who had more perspective, are we in sort of a depressing new era, or has it always felt like a battle for the rule of law?
The question was about the rule of law, which you've talked about a lot tonight, and whether the war, or the so-called war on terror, has eroded the rule of law, or whether during your life it's always been under threat.
The
rule of law.
Yeah.
Is it that since 9/11, there's been an especial threat to the rule of law, or do you think it's been there throughout your life, this threat?
No, I think that indeed there's a special threat. Indeed there is. And it's an incredibly difficult question, of course, of how much of the rule of law you trim in order to deal with this particular threat, which is, of course, a completely new form of threat, in that it's not a country or an enemy that you can get hold of and make war with or suppress, but it's something much more difficult, of course, to cope with. I think the one thing which is completely essential, of course, is to maintain the rule of law throughout and not trim the rule. Because if you're going to be fighting these people, it's no good giving up what you're fighting for throughout. But But it's no good pretending. It's a very difficult balance. And the trouble, the eternal problem is, I'll never forget with Blair, talk about the Iraq war, sitting there and the debate going on about going into the war and so on, and decisions about participating. Well, and him saying, I can quite understand the opposition and the other view, and people are entitled to have a different view. All I can say is, I have done what I thought was right. And if you could see what crosses my desk, I'm sure you would have agreed with me. Well, how do you cope with that? I mean, if you could see what crosses my desk, it's very, very, very dangerous, that. And my whole experience of dealing with the intelligence in MI5 and MI6 and these cases that I've been involved in is that when Mr. X and Captain Y come into the witness box say that they can't divulge this, they can't divulge that, a whole mass of what they say is not secret, is not basically secret. And since we demolished so much of all that secret in the ABC case, we for the first time divulged that MI5 existed, that MI6 existed. We divulged that we had listening posts. We divulged that it was at Cheltenham, that the GCHQ, that we had a listening post in Cyprus. All these things came out of this case. And the judge gradually realized that all this talk of giving listening places numbers and names, even the post office tower was called number 46 or whatever it was completely ridiculous. And as I said earlier, of course the Russians know all this. Of course, they've always known all these things. Now it's all been divulged. It hasn't made the slightest difference. It's what goes on. Of course, what goes on inside, there has to be a security about. But the fact that they exist and the powers they have, it's essential that in some way they are themselves subject to control and by democratically controlled.
I would like to end just by reading the last two paragraphs of the preface to this book by Thomas Grant, because I think it captures what we've heard tonight. It's, of course, Jeremy's voice which was and remains his chief asset. Listening to him speak now, one can understand the mesmeric quality that he exercised in the courtroom. It's a voice which serves as a link to an earlier age and allows one to conjure up a speaking manner lyrical and intonated, but with the capacity for sustained intensity which has been largely overtaken by the flatter tones of the 21st century. While he was outlived almost all his contemporaries, his friendships have constantly renewed themselves, and his social life is, in brackets, almost as active as it ever was. Perhaps the most important truth about the man that has emerged from my research is his capacity for friendship, his ability to inspire the affection and respect of others. His is truly an example of the life well lived. Jeremy Hutchinson, thank you for coming today.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.